Well, good evening, everybody. It's a very great pleasure to introduce Alan Krueger as the 21st Lionel Robbins lecturer. As many of you know, Alan is one of the world's leading labour economists. He's perhaps the greatest expert on the economics of education. He's a great authority on the minimum wage, and he wrote a book which I think we can say had an influence on British history because many of us were worried about what that might do to unemployment, and the book allayed those anxieties and the minimum wage came in. He's also an expert on the economics of rock. He might be going to tell you something about that, but he writes a weekly column in the, not weekly, monthly column, monthly column in the New York Times, and he mentions a topic and he suddenly gets sent a mass of data. He becomes an expert on one thing after another. And I'm particularly happy that he's now becoming an expert on happiness, where he's also making real contributions. Alan is a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, which is like the British Royal Society. But as you can see, he's not an ivory tower economist. He's been in public life under Bill Clinton. He was chief economist at the US Department of Labor. He's very active in our profession. Even something which may surprise you, he is an editor, co-editor, of the Journal of the European Economic Association, which shows you how broad he is in his interests. And as an example of this breadth, he has turned his mind to what is, after all, one of the most important problems of our age and one of the most difficult, and Alan is going to talk to us the first of three lectures on terrorism. Alan.
Thanks very much, Richard, for the lovely introduction. It's a real privilege for me to give these lectures. Let me also say I feel a connection to the London School of Economics. I don't know if Richard remembers, but when I was a graduate student 20 years ago, my advisors were both on leave at the London School of Economics when it was time for me to defend my dissertation. Larry Summers and Richard Freeman were both here. So rather than have them come back to Cambridge, I came here to defend. I picked up Mervyn King as my third reader. So I have very fond memories from that experience, especially when the defense was over and I was able to enjoy London. Let me begin with a little bit of an introduction to the three lectures before I start on tonight's topic. For the last 5 years or so, I've been working on the economics of terrorism, various aspects of the economics of terrorism, and I'm often asked, well, what does this have to do with economics? Why would an economist work on this topic? And the subject of tonight's lecture is, why do individuals participate in terrorism? What are the characteristics of those who participate in terrorism? Can we infer something about their motivation, the causes behind their participation? And I have two answers to the question, why does an economist work on this topic? One is somewhat flip, and the other is more serious, although I think they both are serious. So the flip one is participation in terrorism is just a special application of the economics of occupational choice. Labor economists are, after all, experts on occupational choice. Some people choose to become doctors or lawyers or economists, and others pursue terrorism. If economics could add something on occupational choice in general, perhaps it could be applied to the economics of participation in terrorism. The second and less flip answer is I had done some work previously with Steve Pischke, who is now here at the London School of Economics. And Steve and I looked at the outbreak of hate crimes against foreigners in Germany in the early 1990s. And I'll tell you a little bit more about this work later on. But through this work, I became interested in whether economic factors are play a role in people's participation in hate crimes and then terrorism. The bottom line from the work on hate crimes, which I think carries over to research on the economics of terrorism, is that economic conditions have relatively little to do with the decision to participate in terrorism. And I think that's true at both the individual level and the societal level. Tonight I'll talk about the individual level. Tomorrow, I'll talk at a more macro level. Actually, here's an outline for the three lectures. Tomorrow's lecture is on the more aggregate level, at the country level. What are the characteristics of countries that are associated with being an origin for terrorists or being a target of terrorists? And then the final lecture, I'll talk about the consequences of terrorism, the economic consequences of terrorism, which you'll see I have a fairly broad definition of economics. It reaches into psychology as well as other aspects of well-being. So just so you know that I'm not addressing a straw man, a number of world leaders and prominent thinkers have drawn a connection between economic conditions, lack of education, and the outbreak of terrorism. I'll give you a sampling of some quotes. President Bush, who actually was quite reluctant to draw a connection between poverty and terrorism after September 11th, but I think because he was concerned that he might not look so compassionate and everyone else was drawing a connection, he decided to draw a connection too. In an important speech he gave in Mexico City, in Monterrey, on March 23rd, 2002, George Bush said, "We fight against poverty because hope is an answer to terror." Laura Bush went a little bit further. She said, "A lasting victory in the war against terror depends on educating the world's children, because educated children are much more likely to embrace the values that defeat terror." James Wolfensohn, when he was president of the World Bank, said, "The war on terrorism will not be won until we have come to grips with the problem of poverty and thus the sources of discontent." One might question whether that was also a plea for more support for the World Bank. Tony Blair has on multiple occasions drawn a connection between economic conditions and terrorism. November 13, 2001, he said, "The dragon's teeth of terrorism are planted in the fertile soil of wrongs unrighted, of disputes left to fester for years or even decades, of failed states, of poverty and deprivation." And then, again, in July of last year, he reiterated this point. "Ultimately, what we now know, if we didn't before, is that where there is extremism, fanaticism, or acute and appalling forms of poverty in one continent, the consequences no longer stay fixed in that continent." Elie Wiesel said, "The fanatic has no questions, only answers. Education is the way to eliminate terrorism." I could go on. I could fill up the whole hour with additional quotes. Bill Clinton and Al Gore both made comments along these lines, so you can see it's bipartisan in the U.S. The Turkish Prime Minister has recently made a point of saying that poverty is a cause of terrorism. King Abdullah of Jordan, terrorism experts like Jessica Stern of the Kennedy School, and so on. Now, what I hope to persuade you in tonight's lecture and tomorrow's lecture is that there's very little support for this view. In fact, what's remarkable to me is that so many prominent world leaders, I think well-intentioned world leaders, would draw this connection without having an empirical basis for making the alleged connection. So to give you my bottom line, any effect of education and poverty on terrorism is indirect, complicated, and probably quite weak. Now, I don't know if many of you were here the last time I spoke in this room. I gave a talk here, the Queen's Lecture, a couple of years ago, which was titled "Education Matters," which was a shameless attempt to try to sell some copies of my book by the same title, where I emphasized the benefits of education for society. And I certainly do believe there are many benefits of education for economic well-being and for society in general. I don't think that a reduction in terrorism is one of those benefits, however. In fact, as I'll emphasize, I think an increase in education without focusing on the content of education, if anything, is likely to be counterproductive. So what I would like to do in the rest of this lecture is begin by defining terrorism as well as hate crimes. I'll start with the literature on hate crimes because that's a little bit more developed and older than the literature on terrorism, and I also think it's related. I'll say something about public opinion as it relates to terrorism. Then I'll turn to a profile of terrorists, and then lastly end with some comments about how one should theoretically model participation in terrorism at a conceptual level. If you are interested in reading more about the work underlying my lectures, I'm going to draw primarily from an article I had in the Journal of Economic Perspectives with Yitka Malachkova in fall 2003. I'll talk about some work that I've done extending that. Then I'll discuss, draw from two papers that I have with David Layton, who's a political scientist at Stanford, where we look at the more aggregate level. And I'll also summarize others' work and talk about some of my more recent unpublished work. So let me begin by defining terrorism. Terrorism is a notoriously difficult concept to define. In fact, I think if I were to start in this field from scratch, I would avoid use of the word terrorism. Just use something like politically motivated violence. First of all, terrorism is a tactic. Richard Clark, who was an advisor to several presidents of the United States from the National Security Council, argued that declaring a war on terrorism is a little bit like Franklin Roosevelt, or here I should say Winston Churchill, declaring a war on U-boats at the beginning of World War II. Terrorism is a tactic. It's unusual to declare a war on a tactic. How do I define this tactic? Here you quickly run into a lot of differences of opinion. There are over 100 different scholarly definitions of terrorism. There was a conference of foreign ministers from over 50 Islamic states in 2002 where they agreed to condemn terrorism, but they couldn't agree on a definition of what it was that they had condemned. They couldn't agree on a definition of terrorism. So what do I have in mind? What I have in mind is premeditated, politically motivated violence. Then I put in brackets here because this is what I'll be talking about, but I don't think it's necessary because I think states can engage in terrorism. In brackets, I have perpetrated by sub-state actors with the intent of influencing an audience beyond the immediate victims. So what I have in mind by terrorism, the goal of terrorism is to spread fear. The immediate victims are not of as much importance as the broader message, the broader image sent to the public. Now, one of the problems with the definition of terrorism is it requires some understanding of the motivation of the terrorists. So in that sense, it is something of a subjective definition. And this is something I know that organizations that try to measure terrorist activity really struggle with. I said I'll talk about hate crimes to begin with. I think of hate crimes as a close cousin to terrorism. In fact, I wrote that in one of my monthly articles in the New York Times. And someone emailed me and he said, terrorism is a close cousin to hate crimes. Who says? Which is a fair point. But I do think that they are related. So the definition of a hate crime, the typical definition of a hate crime, is a crime or violent act against members of religious, racial, or ethnic groups because of their group affiliation, not their individual characteristics or actions. Sometimes I'll like to combine about terrorism and hate crimes into a broader category, which I call randomly targeted acts of political violence. Randomly targeted gets at the idea that the victims themselves are random, but the groups are targeted. They're targeted because they want to send a message. And one reason for beginning by looking at hate crimes is that hate crimes are often more of a spontaneous act or more carried out by individuals, whereas terrorist acts are typically filtered or constrained by an organization. So I think of hate crimes as getting at more the pure supply curve of those willing to carry out these revolting attacks. It gets away from this filter of the organization. So let me briefly summarize the literature on hate crimes. The literature, as far as I know, began with a remarkable study by Arthur Raper in 1933, which was called The Tragedy of Lynchings. And what Raper was able to do was to assemble some remarkable data on the number of lynchings each year in the U.S. South and the price of an acre or an acre's yield of cotton. And Raper looked at these data in a book he published in 1933, and he calculated the correlation coefficient between the two series that you see here. In fact, he calculated it to the third decimal point. The correlation was -0.532. Must have been an achievement back then to calculate correlation coefficient with so much precision. Raper looked at these data, and he said, it looks like there is an inverse relationship. When the economy is doing well, as indicated by an increase in the price of cotton, the number of lynchings decline. This finding launched a literature often called the deprivation aggression hypothesis or the frustration aggression hypothesis. In fact, a pair of psychologists at Yale, Hovland and Sears, in 1940, cited Raper's work to argue that deprivation, economic deprivation, leads to aggression. People take out their frustrations when economic conditions are not going so well. And that is, to my mind, the beginning of the literature on hate crimes and the beginning of the literature arguing that there's a connection between economic conditions and something that looks like terrorism. The problem with this view is that the empirical basis for it isn't there. And I actually say this with quite a bit of conviction. Don Green, who is a political scientist at Yale, has a paper where he just demolishes this correlation. For one thing, Green points out that what Raper discovered was two trends that happened to be trending in the opposite direction. If you run a multiple regression and just control for trend, so in other words, look at the deviations from the trends that were taking place, you see no relationship between the number of lynchings and the price of an acre of cotton. If you use better measures of economic conditions, like Kuznet's measure of GDP, you see no relationship. But most importantly, Raper had the misfortune of doing his analysis up until 1929. After 1929, of course, the Great Depression hit. The price of cotton plummeted, economic conditions deteriorated, yet the number of lynchings continued to fall. So if you extend this series by 8 years, what you would see is that the price of cotton crashed, yet the number of lynchings did not shoot up, as one would expect if this was a causal relationship. Instead, the number of lynchings continued pretty much on its downward trend, and the correlation goes away if you add 8 more years of data. Well, that was the initial study that launched this literature. What about the subsequent research? Well, the subsequent research has not been very supportive either. Don Green and two co-authors have a study where they look at the occurrence of anti-gay or anti-Semitic or anti-black hate crimes in New York City, again looking over time using monthly data, and they find no relationship between the unemployment rate and the occurrence of these hate crimes. A different type of study was done by Phil Jefferson and Fred Pryor, who are two economists at Swarthmore. They looked at which regions in the U.S. are home to a hate group. So looking at the county level, they found that 10% of the 3,100 counties in the United States in 1997 were home to a hate group. And the most common type of hate group was the Ku Klux Klan, the KKK. And these hate groups are tracked by the Southern Poverty Law Center, which is where they obtain their data. So they use this information to say, well, what can we predict about the location of hate groups? Are they related to the unemployment rate in the area or the gap in earnings between blacks and whites? And what they found was no relationship at all, looking cross-sectionally. When they looked at the average level of education in an area and how that predicts whether there's a hate group in that area, they actually found a positive correlation. And what they conjectured is that hate groups and the incidence of hate crimes are more likely to occur when there's a breakdown in law enforcement or when there's official sanctioning support for such types of crimes. Then lastly, I thought I'd say a little bit about my work with Steve Pischke. So Steve and I published a paper in the Journal of Human Resources in 1996 where we looked across the 543 counties in Germany. And we were able to get information from a couple of sources, most importantly from news reports on the incidence of violent crimes against Turks, Vietnamese, Yugoslavs, and other foreigners. It wasn't only against Turks, although those were the largest number of victims were Turks. And this map shows you the number of incidents of crime against foreigners per 100,000 residents. And we were able to look at 1,056 incidents that occurred between January 1992 and June 1993. I won't bore you with the details, but there, of course, is some concern that events that are reported in the newspaper are not representative. And we were able to do some comparisons with the official statistics, but we couldn't get the official statistics at this low level of geographic detail. And what do you see here? First, you can see right away that the incidence of hate crimes were a lot higher in the East than they were in the West. Now, that could quite possibly have something to do with the economic circumstances being worse in the East than they were in the West at this time. But I think that's unlikely, because if you look within the East or within the West, as I'll show you in a moment, you don't see much relationship with economic circumstances. Also, if you look within the West, I can give you an example. If you look at the northwest coast area, you see very low incidence of hate crimes, but that was actually quite a depressed area. This next chart shows you the unemployment rate by region. The darker areas have a higher unemployment rate. I could highlight that same area. You can see in the West, this was an area of relative high unemployment, yet an area of relatively low ethnic violence. And our statistical analysis tended to point in the same direction. I won't bore you with the details, but when I went back to look at the paper, I realized that Steve did some fancy modeling. In this analysis, had adjusted for the spatial correlation across counties in the outbreak of violence using a maximum likelihood technique that I had forgotten about. So what did we find from this analysis? Well, first of all, if you don't look within the East or the West, if you just kind of ignore that division, you do find that a higher unemployment rate is associated with higher crimes against foreigners. But as soon as you look within regions, as soon as you put in a dummy variable, simple addition to the model, for whether a county is located in the East or the West, we actually find an inverse relationship between the unemployment rate and the incidence of hate crime. So what that says is that within the East or within the West, areas that had a higher unemployment rate actually had lower number of crimes against foreigners. Population density didn't seem to matter. Population mattered, but not the density. The number of foreigners in an area, or the percent of the population that was foreign in an area, didn't matter. One variable that mattered quite significantly was how far the county was from the West. Areas that were further to the east, within East Germany, had even higher numbers of crimes against foreigners. You can see that from that previous map that I showed you. And it's possible that this was, related to economic conditions, because the further east you are, the harder it is to commute to the West if you want to get a job in the West. On the other hand, we also, in the same type of analysis, we controlled for how far the county was from a city with a low unemployment rate. And controlling for that variable, which seems to be probably the most relevant in terms of economic opportunities for commuters, we continued to find the further east that the county was located, the higher the incidence of hate crimes. That suggested to us a conclusion which was like the one that Jefferson and Pryor drew, that the further from the West, the further from more standard law enforcement and respect for law, the lower or the greater the breakdown was in law enforcement and the higher the incidence of crime against foreigners, even though there were relatively few foreigners as you move further east. So in summary, we found no effect of economic conditions within region, the unemployment rate, the level of wages, wage growth, or education were all unrelated to the incidence of crimes against foreigners. So when you put this together, what the literature on hate crime shows is that whether you look across regions or if you look over time, we see very little connection between economic circumstances and the incidence of hate crimes. Instead, and this is a little bit of a stretch because they're not direct measures of support for law enforcement or respect for the law, but the proxies that we have suggest that law enforcement or a breakdown of law enforcement is an important predictor of the incidence of hate crimes. So let me change gears and show you a little bit of evidence from public opinion polls. And I probably don't want to make too much out of this, but terrorism, of course, does not occur in a vacuum. So the communities from which terrorists arise are relevant. The values held by different segments of those communities are relevant. And public opinion polls can possibly get at those values and views. So I'll begin by showing you very briefly some new evidence from a survey conducted by the Pew Foundation, the Pew Global Attitude Surveys. This was done in February 2004. And in four countries, Morocco, Jordan, Turkey, and Pakistan, they interviewed about 1,000 people in each of those countries. Then I'll talk about some evidence, more extensive evidence from the Palestinian territories. So one of the questions that was asked in this Pew survey was, what about suicide bombing carried out against Americans and other Westerners in Iraq? Do you personally believe that this is justifiable or not justifiable? And here I report the percent who said it was justifiable, broken down by education. So the upper left-hand corner is Morocco, the far right-hand corner is Jordan, bottom left corner is Turkey, and then the far right corner is, lower right corner is Pakistan. And you can see education ranges from no formal education, which in some of the countries, such as Pakistan, is a very large group, up to university education. And the scales of these are worth, I realize that if you're sitting up in the upper level or even in the lower level, you probably have some difficulty reading the scales. So to give you an idea, if you look at Jordan, responses to this question range from about 62% up to over 70%, depending upon the education level. The two top charts use the same scale for the percent saying that they think that suicide bombings carried out against Americans and other Westerners are justified. The bottom scales are lower. So in Turkey, the highest, which is university educated, only goes up to about 34% saying that these attacks are justified. But I've made the range the same in all of these cases, so the differences should look the same to you, should be interpreted the same. And then Pakistan, the scale goes from 35 up to 60%. And what you see by and large is that people are more likely to say that these suicide attacks against Americans and Westerners in Iraq are justified if they have a higher level of education. In Jordan, it's not monotonic, but I think if you were to fit a line through the, and the same thing with Pakistan, it seems to dip down at the university level. But you certainly wouldn't look at these charts and say it looks like there's an inverse pattern, that the uneducated or those who are poorly educated were more supportive. One of the things, and I haven't put together a chart on this, one of the things that one also finds in these data is that those who have a lower level of education are a lot more likely to say no opinion when they're asked questions like these. So I was a little bit concerned about that, but if you look at the difference between those who say it's justified less those who say it's not justified, you see the same kinds of patterns. And these data have just become publicly available. Actually, they're not quite publicly available. The Pew Foundation, fortunately I have a former student who works there, provided these tabulations for me, but they're going to release the full data set next month. And there are some other questions which I won't bore you with, which ask specifically about suicide attacks against Israel, and then suicide attacks in general or to protect Islam. And they generally show the same kind of pattern. I've also broken this pattern down by income level. And the income data are not particularly good in this survey. I have it just for Turkey, Jordan, and for Pakistan, although Pakistan it's in very broad ranges. And in any event, there's no indication that at higher levels of income, people are less likely to say that suicide bombing attacks are justified. In Turkey, they're more likely to say it's justified if they have a higher level of income. And in Jordan, there's a very, very weak relationship, as in Pakistan. Yeah, let me turn to the data from the West Bank and Gaza Strip. And these are data that were collected by the Palestinian Center for Policy and Survey Research, which is an absolutely first-rate survey group headquartered in Ramallah. There's a small blemish on their record, for they were predicting that Fatah had won the last election. Based on their exit polls, but that was inherently a very difficult election to forecast. So they've conducted a series of surveys over the years in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. The data I'm going to show you are drawn from December 2001. To put that time in context, that was just before Israel's major incursion into the West Bank. The surveys were conducted in face-to-face interviews. A total of over 1,300 people were interviewed. They were age 18 and over. Let me show you some of the more interesting questions from this survey. The center was very kind to provide me with some tabulations from the data in the midst of a very difficult time period. So question 16 on the survey asked, in your opinion, are there any circumstances under which you would justify the use of terrorism to achieve political goals? And here I've broken down the responses by education level, and you can see there's relatively little pattern by education. About a third of the public in all education groups said yes or definitely yes. Closer to half said no or definitely no. One thing that leaps out at you is the illiterate were a lot more likely to say no opinion, which is consistent with what I said earlier from the Pew surveys. Those with a low level of education are less likely to express an opinion, which is an interesting fact that I'll come back to because I think that is related to who becomes involved in extreme acts. I should highlight that terrorism here was not defined. So the respondent was free to define terrorism any way he or she liked. And it's clear when you look at the survey data that the definition that respondents used is different than the definition that would commonly be used in the West. For example, in the survey, which was conducted just a couple of months after 9/11, a majority, 53%, said they did not consider the attacks on the World Trade Center on September 11th to be terrorism. They did say that they believe that overwhelmingly the rest of the world would consider those attacks to be terrorism. 82% said they didn't think a suicide bomb attack on the Dolphinarium nightclub in Israel in Tel Aviv, which killed 21 youths, was an act of terrorism. And again, they seem to recognize that the rest of the world would view it differently. I think you get probably more revealing information when the question is asked more specifically. So here the next question said, do you believe that armed attacks against Israeli civilians inside Israel so far have achieved Palestinian rights in a way that negotiations could not? And remember, this was back in 2001 when I would have thought that relatively little had been achieved. And you could see over 60% in almost all groups said yes, they believed the attacks had achieved Palestinian rights in ways that negotiations could not. Very little pattern here by education. One of the things I take away from this is that the Palestinian population believed that the armed attacks against Israeli civilians were efficacious, that they were helping to advance their cause. Interestingly, if anything, well, I would say there's been little change in the responses to this question over time. And I suspect, and the head of the center had told me that his interpretation is that the Palestinians believe that Israel's unilateral withdrawal from the Gaza Strip is an indication that the armed attacks actually had achieved some of their goals that otherwise Israel would not have withdrawn. So who knows, perhaps they're right. I'm somewhat skeptical of that interpretation personally. More to the point, the next question said, concerning armed attacks against Israeli targets, I support or strongly support, oppose or strongly oppose, no opinion. And here you can see that support is stronger among those who have a higher level of education. Interestingly, there's not much of a pattern here with no opinion when the question was asked this way. So if you ask about terrorism in general, about a third across the board say that they think it can be justified. Here you get closer to 80%. Saying that armed attacks against Israeli targets are justified. And the illiterate are actually less supportive, even though 72% said they support or strongly support. If you look at the difference between support or strongly support and oppose and strongly oppose, you got a 46 percentage point difference for the illiterates and a 68 percentage point difference for those who have a high school degree or more. So support seems to be rising with education level. By the way, in September 2004, the same question was asked again. And they were a little bit more specific. They drew a distinction between attacks within Israel or in the West Bank. And you get much stronger, and it's not so surprising, you get much stronger support for attacks in the West Bank. 90% overall said they support or strongly support such attacks. 54% said they support or strongly support the attacks within Israel. and I haven't been able to get those broken down yet by education. I was able to get the question from 2001 broken down by occupation. They didn't have income on these surveys, but occupation is probably a reasonably good socioeconomic status indicator. And a few things to note here. First, the least supportive group is the unemployed. 74% of the unemployed said they support armed attacks against Israeli targets. Compare that to merchants and professionals, 87%. The highest support came from students, which is probably not very surprising since it's not uncommon that students tend to be the most radicalized segment in society. Bear in mind that these are students age 18 and over, so these are primarily college students. Housewives were not too different from the overall population. 82% said they support or strongly support. Now, when I first saw these results, I thought these were really rather shocking. I mean, the level of support for these attacks in the general population was shockingly high. Of course, this is something that people are just saying in a questionnaire, saying to an interviewer. It's not clear it's their heartfelt feelings. Nevertheless, I found it rather shocking. But it's not a and the finding that socioeconomic status, as measured by occupation or education, does not point to the least well-off in society being the most supportive, or at least expressing the most support for attacks against Israeli civilians. It tends to be the better educated and those who are in higher status professions. It turns out that this is not that startling a conclusion. It's actually a very old finding. There was a book by Daniel Lerner in 1958 called The Passing of Traditional Society, a remarkable book in which Lerner, who was a professor at MIT, collected data on extremism in six Middle Eastern countries. And he looked at tabulations. You know, the questions were different, but the idea was the same as these. And he reached the following conclusion. I'll quote from Lerner. "The data obviate the conventional assumption that the extremists are simply the have-nots. Poverty prevails only among the apolitical masses." And I think this is a generally robust finding. The one exception, or the most notable exception, I would say, seems to be Northern Ireland. And that's something I'll return to at the end of the talk. Let me also mention that I looked at the opinion polling data to get a sense of how people were viewing the future. So there were questions in the survey about whether people were optimistic for the future. Do they believe the economy is improving? Do they think that the situation is better over the last 3 years than it was before then, or do they think the situation is worse? And all of these indicators suggest that the population, just before the outbreak of the Second Intifada, the population believed that the economic situation was improving. The unemployment rate objectively was falling, and people expressed views in these public opinion polls which indicated that they thought the economy was improving and they were optimistic for the future. So in this instance of the Second Intifada, it was not a case of dashed expectations for future economic conditions. It looked like optimism was still rising at the beginning of the Second Intifada of September 2000. And that's kind of borne out in time series analyses as well. Now, it's a long way from public opinion polling data to participation in terrorism. And let me turn to the evidence on participation in terrorism. And I'll start in a way in which I'm usually loath to start, by talking about anecdotal evidence. There was a remarkable article by Nasra Hassan, who is a UN relief worker, in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. The article was published in the New Yorker magazine, of all places. And on her own, not part of her official duties, she interviewed 250 militants and their associates who were involved in the Palestinian cause in the late 1990s. And this is what she concluded. "None of them were uneducated, desperately poor, simple-minded, or depressed. Many were middle class, and unless they were fugitives, held paying jobs. Two were the sons of millionaires. One Hamas leader told her, 'Our biggest problem is the hordes of young men who beat on our doors, clamoring to be sent on suicide missions. It is difficult to select only a few.'" Now, this highlights a point that I mentioned earlier, that the organizations do screen those who are involved in the missions, and perhaps they're looking for those who are most able perhaps are looking for those who are most likely to succeed. It makes sense because the cost of failure are very high for the organizations. If there is a failure and act is traced back to the leaders, then that could be quite costly. And that's a point I'll come back to. Let me also mention that Ariel Mirari, who's a psychologist at Tel Aviv University, has studied terrorists and those who were involved in failed terrorist attacks and concluded that they were very unlikely to be abnormal from a psychological standpoint. They didn't seem to be particularly depressed. I have a graduate student at Princeton who wrote his dissertation looking at the characteristics of those who were involved in terrorist activity in the West Bank, or terrorist activity who came from the West Bank and Gaza Strip. And what he did was, rather than just look at those who were involved, he compared suicide bombers and others — here I'll just show you suicide bombers — to the population in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. The first chart here shows you the percent of suicide bombers who came from families that were impoverished versus the population. And you can see that the suicide bombers were much less likely to come from families that were below the poverty line. And if you look at education, it's even more lopsided. Almost 60% of the suicide bombers had more than a high school degree, compared to less than 15% in the population. So remarkably skewed towards better educated. Now, when you look behind these numbers, it's not terribly surprising, because Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad, from whom these data were drawn, recruited mainly on college campuses. Well, who goes to college? It tends to be children from middle class and higher income class families. That's why you see this lopsided educational distribution. I did similar analysis looking at members of Hezbollah. Hezbollah is a multifaceted organization. It has a political wing, a social wing. It had a resistance wing. The organization began in the early 80s, and it was begun to resist Israeli occupation of Lebanon. It was responsible for suicide — it's believed to have been responsible for suicide truck bomb attacks against the U.S. Embassy Marine Barracks in Lebanon, against French paratroopers, and so on. The U.S. State Department and the British Home Secretary have declared Hezbollah to be a terrorist organization, although I will quickly acknowledge that it is a complex organization. The data that I'm looking at, in fact, I would probably more appropriately define as a resistance organization than a terrorist organization at that time. So what I was able to do was get information on the biographies of 129 deceased shahids who were written up in Hezbollah's newsletter, El Ad. The data, which are kind of in summary form, were biographies that were translated by Eli Hurwitz at Tel Aviv University. I turned this into a data set, then I combined it, and I never expected this to be the case. It was actually harder to get data on the Lebanese population than it was on members of Hezbollah. But I was able to get data from the Lebanese population in a housing survey in 1996, 120,000 people aged 15 to 38. Now, the data have serious limitations. Not all members of the Hezbollah sample were engaged in terrorism. You could question whether the sample is representative. After all, in order to get into the data set, they had to have been deceased. Maybe we're more likely to capture the foot soldiers who had a higher mortality rate. On the other hand, it's estimated that about a third of the organization had been killed in action, so it's representing a reasonably large fraction. The data are noisy, the samples are small, and it's a choice-based sample. The population sample also has some problems. It doesn't align perfectly with the years from Hezbollah. Most importantly, I don't have data on religion. So in the analysis I'll talk about, I narrowed the sample to the south of Lebanon, to the more heavily Shiite regions, which is where Hezbollah recruited. And I think one could question whether poverty is defined equivalently in the two data sets. If you just look at the raw data, members of Hezbollah actually had a slightly lower poverty rate than the Lebanese population, 28% versus 33%. Members of Hezbollah, or at least the deceased members, were better educated. 47% of them had a secondary or higher education versus 38% of the population. And members of Hezbollah also seem to be younger. Even though I limited the sample from Lebanon to age 15 to 38, which spanned the age range of the deceased members of Hezbollah in my sample. So I won't bore you with the details, but I used these data to estimate a logistic equation to try to model participation in Hezbollah, controlling for these factors simultaneously. And the one that I just uncovered, the columns I just uncovered, looks at the heavily Shiite areas within Lebanon. And what I find is that members of Hezbollah were better educated than the population, less likely to come from impoverished families, and that latter effect was statistically significant. And also, they were younger. So those results that we saw in the simple summary statistics seem to hold up in more sophisticated regression analysis. I've been focusing on Middle East. I might as well continue by talking about Israel. I looked at membership of an Israeli terrorist organization, underground movement called Gush Emunim, which means Block of the Faithful. This was a religious organization, fanatical religious organization, which was active in the early 80s. It had an attempted attack on the Dome of the Rock Mosque. It tried to blow it up. Fortunately, it failed. It killed 23 people and maimed many others, and it assassinated mayors in the West Bank. And there was a book that was written about the organization by one of its members, Haji Siegel, called Dear Brothers, which summarized the backgrounds of the participants. And I was able to get information on, I guess here, 27 members who he described, and from some other sources. And what one finds, if you look at this list, if you could read it, is that the organization included engineers, teachers, a computer programmer, geographer, combat pilot. It looks like it was drawn from the higher socioeconomic status occupations, not the lower ones. And this is the same kind of picture that one sees in most of the literature. Much of the literature on participation in terrorism kind of goes through biographies, typically culled from newspapers, and you could worry that it might be skewed towards the leadership. Doesn't do anything too systematic to compare the participants to the population at large, but tends to find kind of overwhelmingly that the participants are skewed to higher socioeconomic status occupations. This is also the case with Al-Qaeda, by the way. Mark Segeman, who was a former, I believe, a psychologist for this, maybe a psychiatrist for the CIA, has written a recent book called Understanding Terror Networks Using Unclassified Data. And here he shows the education and occupational backgrounds of members of Al-Qaeda. And this is not comparing it with the population from which they're drawn, but you could see that they're disproportionately in the college-educated group, also tend to be from skilled professions. And it turns out I think there's actually little dispute. This is kind of funny to start the lecture on a topic where I think the literature is pretty much in agreement that most terrorist organizations are composed of people who are drawn from the elites. There was a report, summary report, that was done by the U.S. Library of Congress for an advisory group to the Central Intelligence Agency called The Sociology and Psychology of Terrorism, Who Becomes a Terrorist and Why, which reached this conclusion. And I wanted to mention this report because I first learned about this after September 11th. And you can imagine this was kind of a low-level report for a low-level committee. But I give the Bush administration a great deal of credit because they pointed to this report and said, you know, the Clinton administration probably should have spotted that September 11th would occur because the CIA had been advised that terrorists were planning to take an airplane, fill it with bombs, and slam it into the White House. And they cited this report. And I looked at the title of the report, and I thought, gee, this sounds like a report I should know about. So I read the report. I read it very closely. I thought it was absolutely fascinating, and I could see no mention of terrorists slamming an airplane into the White House. So I did what you could do in the PDF error. I did a Control-F search. And sure enough, there was a footnote buried in this report, and I give them a lot of credit for having found it. The idea that terrorist organizations were becoming more sophisticated, they were composed by well-educated individuals, they'll be able to carry out more sophisticated acts of terrorism. The report, however, had some fascinating discussions of the literature, Here's one of the conclusions it reached. Many terrorist cadres have predominantly middle-class or even upper-class backgrounds and are well-educated, with many having university degrees. Then it pointed to a notable exception. Irish groups such as the IRA are poorly educated. And, in fact, some work on public opinion surveys, a recent one, short piece by my colleague Chris Paxson, looked at a survey question that was asked in 1968, just before the situation went badly downhill in Northern Ireland. And the question that was asked in this questionnaire was, sometimes you hear people say today that it would be right to take any measures necessary in order to end partition and bring Ulster into the Republic. Are you inclined to agree or disagree with that view? 12% of Catholics agreed, 81% disagreed. This survey, I think, was just done in Ulster in 1968. When Professor Paxson looked by education level, what she found was remaining an extra year in school is associated with a 3.2 percentage point reduction in the probability of agreeing. Income appears to not matter. So at least by education, what you see is different from those public opinion polls I showed you earlier. If you look across regions in Northern Ireland, the regions that were more likely to support the IRA and more likely to participate seem to be those that were more depressed. At the same time, there's a time series analysis where you look, this study by Thompson looked from, I think it was 1923 through 1985, at the relationship between the unemployment rate and the number of fatalities in the conflict in Northern Ireland and found no association. So there is something of a difference between the regional data and the time series data. But nevertheless, I think there's enough indicators that the members of the IRA were disproportionately working class, even within regions and within ethnic groups or religious groups, to make you ask, why is it that Northern Ireland looks like it's different? I don't have the answer to that question. I have some conjectures for you. One possibility is ease of immigration, particularly to the U.S., and one possible explanation for why the IRA was drawn disproportionately from the working class is that those who were particularly unhappy used exit instead of, I don't know if you would call it voice, or instead of action, immigrated to the United States, for example. That's a possibility. Another possibility, which is mentioned in the literature from time to time, is that there was discrimination against Catholics, which prevented a middle or upper class from developing. I find that kind of hard to accept because, as the explanation, not that there was discrimination, but as the explanation, because certainly in other situations where discrimination exists, we look at the participants in terrorist organizations, they tend to be still from the relatively well-off, better educated. Then the final explanation is that Northern Ireland may be more like a guerrilla war or civil war than the activities of a small terrorist organization. And there is a literature on who participates in the civil war and whether economic circumstances affect the outbreak of civil war. And in fact, that literature finds that economic activity is a predictor of civil war, that more depressed areas are more likely to undergo a civil war. And I'll come back to that in a few minutes. On the other hand, I think if you look at most of the evidence and if you look at what many of the terrorists say, they don't highlight economic factors. So let me show you this quote, which I'm sure you're all familiar with, from a man who's believed to be Mohammed Sadiq Khan, the leader of the July 7th attacks here. You probably recognize that picture more. In a tape that was aired on Al Jazeera, it is believed that he said, "I and thousands like me are forsaking everything for what we believe. Our driving motivation doesn't come from tangible commodities that this world has to offer." So I take it as explicitly acknowledging that this is not driven by economics. There are economic circumstances, and in fact, it's a very small sample, but the July 7th attackers don't look like they were particularly impoverished. Instead, he goes on to describe his motivation as a retaliation for activities by the West. So let me say a little bit about participation, and then I'll open it up to your questions. The reason why I think that we see the pattern that we see is that although those who have lower socioeconomic status or lower education might have a lower opportunity cost and probably do have a lower opportunity cost of participating in terrorism. They have less that they're giving up in the more legitimate, in the legitimate sector. At the same time, I think they perceive there being much greater benefits. So one conclusion I draw is that the well-off and better educated are drawn to extreme positions. You sort of see this in the public opinion polls. Those who are less educated are more likely to say that they have no opinion. Those who are better educated are more likely to vote. People who are better educated and higher income have a higher opportunity cost of voting, yet that doesn't discourage them from voting, probably because they believe in the process, probably because it's less costly for them to vote because it's less costly for them to become informed. People who have a higher level of education find it easier to acquire information. They seem to have more confidence in their opinions, and that could lead to extremism. Second, and related, if terrorist organizations are small, and I think you tend to get terrorist activities when conditions are not ripe for civil war, the terrorist groups tend to be composed of the elites who care about the cause. They're the first ones to join. On the other hand, if the movement spreads and becomes large enough, then to induce additional people to join the organization, you would naturally have to dip into those who are less committed by the cause, who would be motivated more by pay, and those would be people who are from lower socioeconomic status. So that's one reason why I think when we see civil war, we're seeing a situation which has grown beyond a terrorist organization and spread to a more wider insurgency. And the organizations are not only composed of those who care deeply about the cause, but are composed more and more by mercenaries. Related to this, I think if you think about the demand side, the views of the terrorist organizations, they prefer to have highly skilled individuals carry out the terrorist acts. The costs are very high for failure. There's more skill involved in terrorist attacks than I think is commonly appreciated. You can compare the two London bombings in July. The second attack, which from what we could tell, was a failure and was probably not meant to be a failure, was carried out by people who were less sophisticated, less well-educated, and perhaps that contributed to their failure. And the groups, of course, screen who participates. And especially when it comes to international terrorism, where someone has to fit into a foreign society, I think it's quite reasonable to expect that those who are involved will be better educated and likely to come from higher socioeconomic status backgrounds. So for the most part, I would say that terrorists are not people who have nothing to live for. On the contrary, they are people who believe in something so strongly that they're willing to die for it. And I like to think of this in terms of a market, the supply side and the demand side. By the way, I borrow this from Larry Iacone. Larry has a very interesting paper called The Market for Martyrs. On the supply side, well, of course, the opportunity cost should matter, and the economics of crime and the economics of suicide tell us that people of low market opportunities should become involved. At the same time, it appears to me that the opportunity cost is outweighed by other factors. And as I emphasized before, political involvement requires some understanding of the issues, and that's less costly for those who are better educated. On the demand side, the organizations want to succeed. They want to select more able participants. They also don't want to be predictable. They might want to have something of a randomized strategy. One of the conclusions from Iacone's work, and I think it's supported by my work as well, is that it's very difficult to work on the supply side. People who are willing to sacrifice themselves for a cause often have very diverse motivations. So if we address one motivation and reduce one source on the supply side, there are other motivations. The supply is fairly elastic in that sense. The terrorist groups seem to be quite capable of substituting people from different backgrounds to carry out terrorist attacks. That suggests to me that focusing more on the demand side makes sense. Let me give you a little bit of preview, though, for tomorrow's lecture. One could say, well, everything you described is well and good, but economic conditions still matter. Terrorists are not drawn disproportionately from the ranks of the poor, but they're motivated by inequality in their societies or by the poverty of their countrymen. I call this Robin Hood terrorism. And that certainly is a possibility, and I think nothing I've shown you tonight will rule that out. Hopefully what I show you tomorrow will cast some doubts on that. And let me just conclude by saying, why is the popular stereotype wrong? After all, I started the lecture by quoting several world leaders who argued that poverty and lack of education are a cause of terrorism. And I have a couple of conjectures for why there's demand for that view. One is that we tend to see things through Western eyes, which tend to be materialistic. We tend to think about economic circumstances motivating a great deal of attention, a great deal of activity. It's also easy to have a simple answer. If we could say that those who are attacking us, attacking our way of life, are doing so because they're desperate or because they hate our way of life, well, that's very easy. On the other hand, it's a lot more complicated if we say, well, they're motivated by some grievance. They're concerned about American activity in the Middle East, for example, American bases in Saudi Arabia. If we acknowledge the motivation is stemming from some political cause, then we have to confront their grievances. Now, we may not want to confront their grievances, and I think it's quite legitimate for the West to say these grievances are not appropriate, and this is an inappropriate way to express it. But I think it's wrong for the West to not realize that consequences of our policies have caused responses. One of the great contributions of economics is the idea of a response function. If one party does something, the other party may respond. I think, of course, it's important to take those responses into account to be able to predict them. Then finally, I would say that just because education and income don't seem to be a big part of the motivation for terrorism, it doesn't mean they can't be part of the solution. I'm somewhat pessimistic that they would be an important part of the solution. On the other hand, I think it is important to improve education and reduce poverty around the world. I don't think anything I've shown you on terrorism will change that, should change that view. If education is to be part of the solution, I think it's important that we think about the content of education. Merely increasing years of schooling with the same school system that exists now, I don't think will improve the situation. It will probably lead to more extremism. And I also think it's dangerous if we have this false connection between poverty and education and terrorism, because if we do, as George Bush has done, actually, motivate support for international aid as part of the war against terrorism, once the fear of terrorism recedes, support for international aid might also recede. And I think that would be quite unfortunate. I think it's better to pursue. And the same kind of thing, by the way, happened after the end of the Cold War. I think that the West has an obligation to try to increase economic development around the world. And I think drawing a false connection between poverty and terrorism can indeed be counterproductive when it comes to reducing poverty around the world. So why don't I pause at that point and I'll take questions.
Right, well, what a fascinating picture of such a complicated area. Who wants to ask the first question or make the first point? No.
Thanks. Professor, a lot of the data you presented there is data from Islamic countries, which shows that an increase in education leads to an increase in terrorism, or at least there's a correlation between the two. This is contradicted by your evidence from Northern Ireland, and I think also by evidence from Sri Lanka, where terrorism is conducted by a maligned minority. Is it therefore not possible that there is a link between further education in Islamic countries, such as Pakistan or Turkey, and so could a solution not be more tolerant education, broader education rather than less education? Thank you.
That's a good and a complex question. I'm not familiar with Sri Lanka, so I really can't say. I could tell you that the research on the Latin American terrorist organizations find the same profile that I've emphasized today. I suspect that, first of all, I think it's very very hard to change people's opinions. And education, I think, has many benefits. I think that we kind of delude ourselves if we think it's going to lead to more consensus and to some extent. One concern I do have is that education in many countries is not preparing people for careers. Tomorrow I'll talk about kind of religious aspects, where I don't think that terrorism is that any particular religion has a monopoly on support for terrorism or terrorism. So I didn't mean to highlight Middle Eastern groups because I think they stand out or particularly responsible for terrorism. I did it in part because I think that's the that's the main concern at the moment. I also tried to emphasize Israeli terrorists as well. So I tend to view Northern Ireland as kind of an exception that we don't understand, rather than a case which I think we should kind of expect to be relevant in other places. It seems to me that there's a long step. Even if we found a positive correlation, it's a big step to say it's a causal relationship. Having found the zero correlation or an inverse correlation, I think it's an even bigger step to say that there's going to be a positive correlation. On the other hand, since there does seem to be a lot of support for trying to do something with education in response to terrorism, I think that we ought to recognize that it's not only years of schooling, it's not only getting people into school, it's also examining the content of the education.
Hello, Luke. I think a good area to study what I think you're trying to say would be Indonesia, because when the Asian economic miracle was going full steam, Indonesia had a kind of Islam which would be called cultural Islam, rather like Turkey. It wasn't, I've been there many times, and it wasn't, you'd be battling to strike fundamentalists in Indonesia before, I'd say, 1994. But when the Asian economic miracle occurred, most of the wealthy got out, the education, the schooling education system collapsed, and that's when the madrasas of the teaching, Muslim teaching schools moved in from Yemen. Abu Bakr Bashir is a Yemeni, the leading person who's on trial of the Bali bombings. And it's then, from 1995 onwards, that you have a rise in fundamentalism. So this would coincide with your agreement that it's the content of education that is highly important. And I think Indonesia might be an ideal research vehicle, what you're doing, because you can see before terrorism and after.
Right. Thank you. Tomorrow I'll talk a little bit about the world more generally. I also should have mentioned earlier, the Palestinians are particularly well-educated, but a lot of the education tends to be religious. If you look at the content of the textbooks, it's to my mind, quite shocking often. So that, I think, emphasizes the same point, that the content of education is relevant.
To my perception,
thank you.
The way you define terrorism is very much inspired by Western perception.
Can you speak up?
The way you define terrorism, I think, it's very much defined in a Western perspective. And I was just wondering, for people like myself who are not from the West and come from the Middle East, there is completely another dimension to terrorism, which is headed by the United States of America, which is large scale terrorism, killing in hundreds of thousands through deception and through very advanced technology to gain whatever they want. For people in the Middle East and those who actually get into suicide bombing because of their belief systems, that is an ultimate truth. For them, United States and their allies, and the way they attack and occupy countries outside their domain, it actually they are the cause of international terrorism. I was just wondering why, in your definition of terrorism, there was no room at all for that side of the story.
Oh, I wouldn't say there's no room for that side of the story. The uh, I, tried to be pretty clear in saying that I'm going to look at sub-state actors. I'm not denying that countries can engage in terrorist activity. I think if you look at U.S. bombing in Tokyo during World War II, you know, firebombing, clearly a big part of the goal was to cause fear and disruption in society, which I would call terrorism. I think the model that one would have for state-sponsored, for state terrorism, state-carried out terrorism, is very different than the model that one would have for looking at individual participation in terrorism. So it seems to me a different subject. I don't think it's a subject which is not worthy of analysis. There is a certain aspect to terrorism in which the victor gets to call gets to define terrorism. And I was reading that the Brits call George Washington a terrorist. Under the Patriot Act, I think that might be an offense, you know, a federal offense in the United States. So I mentioned earlier, if I were to start this all over again, I wouldn't use the word terrorism. I would be a little hard to come up with a title. But I think of what I'm studying as politically motivated violence carried out by sub-state organizations with the goal of trying to spread fear and affect more than the immediate victims. So I certainly don't deny that countries can perpetrate terrorist acts. And in fact, in tomorrow's lecture, I'll make another plea for tomorrow's lecture, one of the things I look at is occupation. And if one country occupies another or tends to occupy other countries in the world, does that make it more of a target for terrorist activity? And I won't tell you the answer, so you have to come to see it.
You've suggested to view terrorism as a particular occupational choice, but if you just think of it as a particular type of crime, then a natural way for national literature to look at is the literature that looks in general on the effects of education on crime. And I believe that if you look at the work that, for example, Enrico Moretti has done, that there's a very robust relationship that education actually reduces crime in general. Would you agree that there's a certain tension between these two literatures that we can see there?
I used to think there was intention, and now I think there's less of a tension. And the reason why I say that is the literature tends to find for property crime that education and poverty are predictors, and you can question whether it's causal or not. I think Moretti uses the approach Angrist and I pioneered on using compulsory schooling as an instrument, if I remember the paper. But if you look at the literature on violent crime, there's actually no relationship between economic circumstances and the likelihood of perpetrating violent crime. So in that sense, I think it is related to the empirical findings in the literature on crime. It's kind of a puzzle in the literature on crime, I would say. On the other hand, you could say that these are acts of passion and people kind of temporarily lose sense of what the opportunity cost is of their actions. But I think, you know, I've thought about this long and hard, and I think that one of the reasons why people have the presumption that terrorism would be carried out by people who are poor and uneducated is they think of it as other types of crime. And I think a more appropriate analogy is to voting. It's a form of political expression. An inappropriate form of political expression, a violent one, one that I don't think should be acceptable. But I think that that's a better analogy than crime. And you know, then you say, well, why is it that people who are better educated or higher income are more likely to vote? It tends to be that even though their opportunity cost is higher, they tend to get more benefit from the outcome or think that they benefit from the outcome or they find it less costly for other reasons.
That's just a comment. The Gush Emunim, which you referred to as the name of the terrorist group, is actually the name of the entire religious settler movement in Israel. And I believe that the particular terrorist movement you refer to was called Brit Zion. I'm not quite sure, which means sort of the covenant of Zion, but certainly it had a more specific name, although presumably their members were also member of the larger settler, religious settler movement, which is called Gush Emunim. But certainly that is not... the entire movement is not. The entire movement is called Gush Emunim. But also, I have a question about highly educated and higher socioeconomic status people participating in terrorism. You said it might that they also tend to support more extremist positions in general. But is that true for voting, for example? So can you generalize that? I mean, is it true that, let's say, in Europe, where you have extreme right political parties, they are supported by highly educated people, which would seem to sort of have to be the case if you want to be consistent with the general model you suggested?
Well, I'm not familiar with the groups in Europe, but I'll tell you, in the U.S., if you look, there's very little. If you look at the pattern of voting and the way people express their opinions in public opinion surveys, very little connection between how they vote and their self-interest, where you judge their self-interest from their education or their income tax bracket. And if you look at the extreme left and the extreme right in the U.S., they tend to be disproportionately people who are well-educated. When I say extreme left and extreme right, I mean the political, if you look at politically conservatives and politically liberals. We can talk about this further. My understanding of Gush Emunim is it may well be the name for the adopted for the whole settler movement, but it's also the name for the underground organization. And the literature I've seen doesn't seem to dispute that, but we can discuss that if you like later.
Hi. When you talked about the role of education and the role of higher occupational levels, and somebody else in the audience mentioned madrasas and religious schools in relation to Islamic terrorists, is there not a more, say, aggregated variable that has a role which might be termed openness to information? Whereas the longer you stay in education, the more accustomed you become to taking in new information and bringing it into the way you relate to the wider world. Therefore, the longer you get exposed to that kind of environment, the more likely you are to be able to relate to or perhaps become involved in these kinds of activities.
Well, I think that's consistent with the way I was interpreting things, that the more education people have, the more open they are perhaps to other views, maybe extreme views. I think there's something about education which also makes people more self-confident, more confident in their own views, which is one reason why they're more willing to express an opinion. I said to John Van Reenen earlier, if you were to run a confidence scheme, like a Ponzi scheme, you'd probably do better off getting people who were successful and well off, who think they know what they're doing, rather than people who are skeptical. And that often, I think, is associated with education.
Okay, last question.
Yeah, thank you. Someone made a critique, the lady there, about Eurocentricity and the definition. I accept that, but that's not going to be my point, because I've been focusing on the solution to this problem. Presumably, that's what you're also trying to do. Although people like Rumsfeld do talk about a war that doesn't end, just at Munich recently. Having said that, I think that instead of looking at the so-called people who are causing the problem, I think it would be in the public, in the taxpayers' interest, and for the world's harmony, if we started looking at the cable and elites who perpetrate political and economic terrorism in the West. And a lot of work is being done on things like the CFR, Council for Foreign Relations, the Trilateral Commission.
Sorry, are you going to ask a question or make a statement?
Yeah, I've made my point.
No, and are I think you asking a question?
Yeah, my question was, it would be in everyone's interest, not just Europeans, to pay attention to the hidden cable underpinning the Bretton Woods global financial economic system. Thank you.
Well, thanks for your question.
I think that's a good note on which to end. I think this is an amazing example of how one should investigate a problem in this careful, systematic, empirical way, trying to build up the evidence to understand what's going on here. And I think we can look forward to more at the aggregate level, which may address some of the problems that people have raised. So I hope everybody will come along. Same time tomorrow. And Alan, thank you for a wonderful start.
Thank you.